Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Today, my guest is Sarah Loudon, and she is the founder and executive director of Total Health, the largest provider of free oncology medical education in the United States, dedicated to improving clinical practice and treatment outcomes for people living with and after cancer. A first-generation immigrant of parents from England and Trinidad, both in the healthcare field, Sarah grew up believing that with hard work and perseverance, no dream was beyond reach. From early work in cancer research to building a cancer center in the Caribbean, and now to being the only female owner and director of an oncology, medical, and patient education company, she actively pursues her mission to reach people at their most vulnerable points and to empower them with information and access to both hope and health. At the age of 45, Sarah established herself as a global force for good in the cancer care space. Her company partners with some of the most respected cancer providers and with many of the most renowned education and advocacy organizations in the world. Sarah and Total Health are also on a mission to improve healthcare equity in cancer care, enhance access to quality cancer care, and reduce disparities in healthcare delivery for all patients, including people of color and those who are underserved. Sarah currently lives in South Florida with her husband and two sons. In addition to serving the oncology community through Total Health's medical and patient education programs, she focuses on continued learning about holistic management of autoimmune disease, a passion fueled by her own diagnosis in 2019. Outside of her efforts within the medical community, she can be found working on her Bible study, spending time with her family, and traveling with her husband. You're a busy girl, Sarah Loudon.
I try to be.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. This is such an amazing platform for people living with autoimmune. I really commend you for the work that you do.
Oh, I just get to show up and do the easy part. The Spondylitis Association and everyone else gets the credit. So tell me a little bit about, first, Total Health sounds really cool. Can I ask you, like, as before we get into that, this is a platform for education. Yeah. And what inspired you to do that?
So really all my life, I have been connected in some way to health education, medical education. My dad was a doctor. My mom is a nurse. I felt really drawn, not just to like learning about different areas in health, but like really figuring out how do you share that with the people that need it the most. And so about 9 years ago, I started this very small, you know, local programs, dinner programs type thing. And today we are the largest provider of oncology medical education in the US, issuing tens of thousands of learner certificates a year and really reaching, especially since COVID, outside the US, which is areas that really need more advocacy, more education, et cetera. So it is a cool thing. I mean, it feels very much like you get to live your mission, but you are living it with real purpose because you know the people on the other side need it really badly, especially when they're living with a cancer diagnosis.
Oh, yeah. It's so critical. And it makes me think of Immerman's Angels. Do you know this?
Oh, group? Definitely. We work with them. Absolutely.
Aren't they amazing? Johnny Immerman is like, he's just a ball of light. And I know he's now moved into some of the other things and isn't as involved in the day-to-day, but is just, when I was reading it, Total Health, it made me think of Johnny. So, if you get to work with that group, you're very
They are a fantastic group.
Oh, really? So we definitely a shout out to them. Okay, so let's not get into the weeds because I could talk to you as an entrepreneur myself for hours about this. Take us back to the beginning of your journey with spondyloarthritis and symptoms, and what challenges did you face getting your diagnosis?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I sit at all in a unique position when I say it was a long, hard, confusing, and often very hopeless start. You know, you go to your primary with your basic, like, I'm not feeling so well. You know, I've got pains, aches and pains here. I don't feel like I should necessarily, you know, I'm not extremely active. I'm not hiking. I'm not this. I didn't have any injury, whatever it might be. And it's like, you know, just take some Advil, give it some time, maybe pick up some yoga, like nothing, no screaming, because it is so in your mind, ununique, unremarkable. And I remember distinctly the day that really everything changed for me. I was walking in the mall. I had a baby about 6 months before, maybe 8 months before, and I was walking in the mall during Christmas time. And this horde of young teenage girls were walking towards me, and they all had heads down in their cell phones, like they were going to collide with me. And here I am with all my bags, and I'm rushing. I'm a procrastinator. And I stepped to the side of them so that, you know, we wouldn't collide. And I felt this pop in my foot. And I just thought, like, that was so weird. I must have just stepped wrong. Well, by the time I got to my car, I was covered in sweat. I was in so much pain. And I thought, what could I have done? I went to the urgent care place. I could hardly walk. I went to the urgent care, got an MRI of my foot. And they said, you tore a tibial tendon in your foot. And I thought, that's so strange. They said, follow up with your doctor. I followed up with my primary, who sent me to an orthopedic doctor who looked at my foot and said, you know, this is common as like a tennis injury or things that you have very significant movement. Very strange, might have just been a freak thing. And from that day, which was actually years before my diagnosis, my whole body began to break down to the point where I couldn't lift the baby. I couldn't do basic things. I had a two-story house at the time, and there were times where I was on my hands and knees crawling up the stairs because I just had, you know, neck to toe pain. And I'd need to take naps in the afternoon. And I think the most significant part of the story is during those years, I visited a dozen doctors. And every time they would talk about what could be going wrong, how I could be, you know, maybe I am gaining too much weight. Maybe I am working too hard. Maybe I am, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody really got to the root of it, which was something about this 30-something-year-old woman isn't adding up. And we've got to get to the bottom of it. And I went into a deep depression, which was very unlike me. And, you know, I was the mom of a newborn with a teenage boy, and I didn't have any joy in my life. I mean, it robbed me of everything that I had.
I have to say, that is, you talking through it, it brings back some of my own journey, and I'm sure hundreds of thousands of others.
Yeah.
But one thing you said in there at the very beginning was, to you, the pain was not unremarkable.
Right.
And I often say to people, I don't know. I actually don't know what it's like to wake up not in some, just now it's very minimal, but you don't know what it's like to even not be in pain ever.
Yeah. It's,
and when it gets where you got to, and you went through all the things that so many women and men go through in the diagnosis cycle, is just, and that was how many years for you?
This is over about 4 or 5 years. I just searched. I remember going into a doctor's office and literally begging them, like, please find something wrong with me.
Yeah,
you know, me too. It's not in my head. It's something is happening. I got answers like, it might be in your head. Maybe we need to send you to a psychiatrist. Or, you know, the classic, like, this sounds like fibromyalgia. Nothing right. We can do to help you. And, you know, you just sit there and go, okay, but, you know, what if something terrible is wrong? In my line of work, remember, there's misdiagnosis of multiple myeloma and like all right. of these other cancers. And so I kept thinking, like, somebody better find something because something is happening with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, very, very difficult start. And like I said, unfortunately not unique to me.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we feel very alone in it, at least when you're going through it. But when you did get the diagnosis, talk about some of the treatments you've tried and what's effective and what's yeah. not effective for you personally.
Yeah. So, you know, the path to my diagnosis was a friend of mine from Colombia said to me, have you seen a rheumatologist? Cause this was, you know, I would see him like once a year at a big breast conference. And he's like, have you seen a rheumatologist? And I was like, no, nobody ever pointed me in that direction. And he's like, oh, let me get you on the phone with someone in New York. I mean, here I am in Florida. And it's like, we're not dealing with a unicorn disease here. Why did it have to come to this point where, you know, someone's like playing house MD, trying to figure out what's wrong with us when this is, you know, there should be some type of triage here. But he made me talk to his friend, a rheumatologist, who pointed me to a local person she went to school with, and she said, go see her. And I went and I said to the doctor, I mean, this, I had gone to the point where, like, you know, I was desperate with doctors I was almost obnoxious with doctors. I said to her, I don't want to see you or have you establish me as a patient if you're not committed to finding something, because I don't have the time. And like, you don't have, I mean, I really got so angry or bitter about what I was experiencing. Anyway, she was very kind and very patient, and she ordered 19 draws, like 19 vials of blood and 9 x-rays and MRIs. And I thought, this girl is serious. Like, this person is going to look. And I got my diagnosis, which is another kind of, you know, it's so, it again feels so mystical. Like, I think it might be such and such. But I got my diagnosis, and immediately she was like, normally we step therapy you know, we start with a steroid or a meloxicam or something. I immediately want you to consider a biologic. And that was a little bit terrifying, because it was like, first I was so excited and happy and grateful that I had a name to this, although it was very hard to pronounce. And the next step was like, oh, like an injection for the rest of my life, you know, like, whoa, this is a new territory here. And so I did a lot of reading as much as I could. And I noticed that, you know, later in life, cancers were reported as side effects to this. But I thought, let me try it. And so I started with Enbrel as my yep. first biologic. Which again is a journey on its own.
Yeah. I hear you. Just in general, the biologics, things can get worse. You think you're at the worst.
Yeah.
And then you introduce something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you feel, but I encourage people to stick with it for a bit.
Yeah.
Because our systems are so out of whack by the time we get those in our system sometimes.
Yeah.
So you had some of the signs.
As patients, we're so used to, you know, you have a migraine, you take a medicine, you don't have a migraine. You have, you know, a heart issue, you take a medicine, you don't have it. And then when you go on the biologic, it's like, wait, when is it? Like, I'm still hurting. I'm still fatigued. I'm still this. Like, when is it supposed to get better? And that answer is vastly different for patients. So it goes against the natural grain of everything we know about the way we treat or are treated as a patient.
Yeah, it gets to be very discouraging when you're thinking you're going to get a little bit better, and it is something that your system has to really get used to. So did you stick with Enbrel or did you move on to another treatment?
No, I was on Enbrel for about a year and a half. And my early treatment was like nothing. I didn't have really any side effects. I didn't even have like site reactions, nothing. Oh, wow. But it wasn't until maybe 3 or 4 months after I started where I would wake up and my hands wouldn't hurt. Or, you know, you mentioned like, every day we wake up in pain. And I would think, I don't remember the last time, like if I knew the day before I was sick, that was like the last day I would be healthy, I would have made it a point to remember things better, because now I don't have a recollection of what that's like. So I would wake up and everything was like, wow, I'm a little bit loose. My shoulders, my back, my hips, like things aren't feeling bad. And for about 6 to 8 months, that's how I was. I was feeling like, this is good. Like I can function. And then it started. It's like my body was like, gotcha. I know what you're trying to do. And it started, you know, tapering down, and I would wake up more and more and more pain. And yeah.
And it's tough. It's, so, I mean, you obviously, have a very busy professional life, and how do you manage that? If you have any hacks, let me know. But how do you manage that? I mean, you seem to be doing travel and running a team and all the things that leave no time for a chronic disease.
Yeah. You know, Jill, finding balance took a long time, like a really long time, and came with a lot of pain in itself, because I remember, you know, close to as the Enbrel was starting to taper, it was 2020, and we went on an RV trip, and I went into an enormous flare. My throat swelled up. I had huge abscesses in the back of my throat, and I ended up in the emergency room. And I made the decision there in the emergency room that what I was going to do was check myself into a health retreat. And I got to the point where I reached out from the hospital bed to a number of retreats, and I found this place in West Palm Beach called Hippocrates. And I'm happy to go into some of the things that we experienced through the health retreat and some of the things that we learned. But that was very hard in itself, because my body just made the decision that it was no longer going to support the things that I was learning to do on my own. And so when you think about a person that is a mom and is a wife and is a business owner and, you know, all the other roles and hats that we wear, going to a health retreat for the better part of 5 weeks was not something that was easy to do. But I really believe that, and I believed at the time, if I didn't do it, I would die. Like I would die. Something would come, I would come to the place where I would feel like it's too much. All of it is just too much. And so I went there for 5 weeks, and it really changed my life. It changed my outlook on kind of the therapeutic decisions that we make as an autoimmune community, what environmentally we can do without. And I always am so careful to say this. I am not one of the people that believe, you know, you go gluten-free, you're healthy. You start yoga and meditation, you're healthy. Like, I do not believe that. But I do believe that there are things that exist in our environment that do worsen our experience with autoimmune disease. So this was one of the things that really kind of put me on this new trajectory of how I was going to manage being who I wanted to be and knowing that I was going to have this constant companion as my autoimmune disease diagnosis.
Wow. I need the name of that place.
It was transformative. And, you know, since then I've learned about so many other places, Canyon Ranches and like all of these really amazing places that I think what they do is as quickly as we receive our first symptoms and then our diagnosis, I mean, we did not take a breath. And these types of retreats give us the opportunity to grieve our old life.
Sure.
And to start to design our new life. And unfortunately, that's not accessible for all of us. But when it is, I believe it's mandatory.
Yeah, it's fascinating too, because I think you nailed it. You're so like self-aware. You do keep going. You've been going for years exhausted or however long between the onset and the diagnosis, and then you get it. And I can tell you and I are very similar personalities. And then you just keep going. And I'm with you. I just last week, in fact, realized I was like, I've been going so fast for so long that I slowed down. And all of a sudden I was like, wow, I don't think I've taken a breath in 6 months and my body hurts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the balance is huge. I've never managed to completely strike it.
Yeah. You know, I think in a way it's a trauma response. I think it's that at some point we feel so like disabled that if we don't prove that we are able, someone's going to figure it out. You know, someone's going to be like, this person's not at the top of their game, or, you know, and I also think that it's the fear of what will we not be able to do as and if our disease progresses. So let's get it all in now. And I do believe that those are trauma responses.
I think they are in some ways. And I certainly agree with you because I've seen it through myself. And it's probably why I didn't talk about the diagnosis at work for the first several years. And you don't want people to judge or, you know, I didn't want people to pity me at work. And I think when I first told my boss and the next morning I was in the gym and he was like, are you sure you should be doing that? And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think you do, I feel like I went through what you experienced where you just really couldn't get out of bed or pick up your kids. Yeah. And it lasted a couple years.
Yeah.
And then I got the diagnosis that back to better lasted a couple more years. And I think it's also like, I think of it in terms of, I don't ever want my health to be taken away again. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do everything I can, at least in the short time. I remember when COVID hit, probably the first day, everybody was excited. Like we get to be home for 3 weeks or 2 weeks. And I saw the writing on the wall and I was like, if I have to be in this house every day, I am going to jump out a window. Cause I've done that, right? I've been trapped in the house where you feel helpless.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's a combination and it's probably different for everyone, but you seem to share a lot of the things a lot of us ladies have when we have AS. So support systems, and maybe comment on people personally, and do you lean on your team professionally when you need some support there?
Yeah. I mean, support systems for me, like really starts at home. I'm so grateful that I have my guys, my husband, my boys that have embraced me in so many ways that, you know, when I think like I'm asking too much of them, they're always like, never, like there's nothing that you could need or ask that we're not right here for you for. So having that, I think, is such a blessing that, again, not all of us have. And then when I did get my diagnosis, I started kind of venturing into the secret world of Facebook groups where, you know, that's such a double-edged sword because you have the people that are in there that are needing the attention of pity, the things that we don't want. And then you have the other people that are like posting, this is helpful, that's helpful, this is helpful. And so, but the one true thing that you get from that is you are by no means alone. And that to me was like rocked my world a little bit because first I thought, how can so many people be living with this and like this?
Right.
And yet the support systems in our healthcare community are literally not there. And so that was one thing. And then my team, I mean, I've had to cancel 3 work trips this year because I just cannot get on the plane. And I am a very transparent and vulnerable leader. And I always make sure that people understand like exactly where I am, what I'm experiencing, and what I need from them. And I've been blessed to be able to have that type of support system at work. So I am a person that has a great level of support all around me and wouldn't in any way be able to live the kind of big life in terms of the things that I'm able to do without that.
Yeah. It makes such a difference. And I think we do think that we ask too much of the people in our lives, but most people love to help. So one thing let's dig into, Total Health focuses on oncology and is your business day to day. And an oncologist directed you to a rheumatologist. And how important, you must have a vast understanding of cancer care. How important has that been in your own journey, do you think?
It's been as important as just recognizing that we don't have the same level of multi or interdisciplinary services in autoimmune and rheumatology than we do in oncology. Nowhere near. I mean, you think when you're diagnosed with a breast cancer, you're seeing a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, a nurse navigator, a breast radiologist. I mean, you've got now there's integrative oncologists that are helping you with diet and movement and mental health and all these other things. And these people are meeting on a weekly basis at their tumor boards to talk about you. Like you are their focus for that hour and a half where they're talking about how do we manage this person's care. So the fact that, you know, I could have a rheumatologist, a neurologist, a primary care, an ortho, and a psychologist or psychiatrist, none of whom who talk to each other, no one who's managing the disease holistically, I think that that's a real disservice to patients who can't access that at like an MD Anderson or a Mayo or one of these big, you know, multidisciplinary centers. And so my advice to anyone who's being managed by multiple physicians or physician groups is walk with your medical records. Like before you leave every visit, ask for the visit note and anything else pertinent to what happened at that particular visit and take it to the person who's in control of your primary care, which might not be your primary care, like your family doctor. It might be your rheumatologist. Or if you have a autoimmune that affects your gut, it might be a gastroenterologist. But it's your, unfortunately, at this time, it's your responsibility to make sure that the person who is managing your holistic care has all the tools and resources about you to be able to do it. And my greatest hope is that we move closer to that type of model for autoimmune diseases because it removes the responsibility from the patient who is dealing with a very vulnerable season in their life and doesn't know what we don't know yet. So to me, that difference between oncology and rheumatology, or even that connection between those two, has kind of opened my eyes to the things I can do to help support others living with autoimmune.
I love it. So a little more on that. Do you think it's research or awareness raising to get us there?
You know, one thing that today, my sister, who has skin disease, she also has autoimmune in her life. As you know, so much of us, this is familial.
Yes.
But my sister's up at Mayo in Jacksonville right now for a consult for something there. And I called her on FaceTime and she said to me, "You look so great today." I had this thing I did this morning. She said, "You look so great today." And her very next sentence was, "But how do you feel?" I could say the same to you, Jill. Like, if I know that you're living with something like I'm living with, I could say, "You look amazing, but how do you feel?" But for the general population, the sentence stops at, "You look amazing," period. And so I think for us as a community, so much of the lack of advancement is we are silent sufferers. We're not dealing mostly with terminal illness. So we don't get the, you know, attention and spotlight as people with cancer. We're not dealing with the take a pill and it's all going to be better. So we don't get the heart disease side. We're dealing with this in between where you look fine. So the expectation is that you are fine. And there's over 100 of the things that fall into, probably more of the things that fall into autoimmune. So if I say I have autoimmune, you might say I have IBS or I have lupus or I have this or I have. And so none of us are the same. So the organization around it is not as tight as those dealing with these other disease groups. And I think while autoimmune captures the top in pharmaceutical sales, second only to, I mean, cancer is second to autoimmune, there's not an urgency. There's not an urgency for us because we're not, quote, sick. We're just managing things that are happening in our day. I do believe that it has a lot to do with that. And I think that's why organizations like the Spondylitis Association's work is vital, because without you, there's no one advocating for us as a group. And we're all kind of left out there on our own devices.
Right. That's interesting. I think it's, you made me think of, I think it was 1949, the World Health Organization came out with their definition of like well-being. And what that means, and you were describing it because it's the, and this was 1949, but we still don't treat patients, at least in our area, mostly like this, that health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity.
Yeah.
And some people argue that that is actually what well-being is, but I think this is what we're after, right? Like, there's health, there's being unwell. We're all looking for that well-being lift, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, I wonder too, is it research that holds us back, like not having enough research in the area? There's plenty, there's not plenty of cancer research. There's a lot of cancer research, but if there was plenty full amount, we probably wouldn't have cancer around. But the idea that we're just seeking that whole well-being premise, right?
Yeah.
Because you can be well with a disease, like spondylitis, I believe. But I guess it is the silent suffering. How do we change it? What do you think?
Oh my gosh, we use our big, powerful, beautiful voices.
Yeah.
At every platform, in every room, in every audience that we have the benefit of having. That is how I think we do it.
And yeah.
I've seen the change that happens when you put a, like, illuminate something, because humans have that natural instinct to say, like, how can I help? And I think if we not only use the voice to say, this is the thing that's wrong, but then in the reaction of how can I help, it's like, here's things you can do to help.
Right.
And you make it low hanging so that people can grab onto it and say, yeah, that's easy for me to do. And that's how we get there.
Yeah. You want to, I think the way you're describing is like activating something to illuminate opportunity, and then people want to grab on. And that's beautiful. And even, you know, this week, the episode of Spondycast that aired was with Dr. Leanne Gensler. And when she was talking about like racial and gender disparities in the disease, liminal space between Black History Month and National Women's History Month. And the one thing that Dr. Gensler said in that episode was that was so astounding to me when I re-listened to it was, oftentimes when we are not heard, our outcome is compromised. Yeah. And this is, you're right, it has to be the voice of what's going on and how do we articulate that and how do we bring inspiration? Wow, I want to do a collab with you.
I'm ready anytime.
I don't want to keep you all day. But despite the challenges of all of this, you also live your best life. Mm-hmm. What is your outlook for the future? And how do you maintain all your positivity and resilience?
You know, I think the first thing is everybody's got kind of that core fundamental thing that just makes them tick, keeps them going. Like, what do you lean on when the time is the darkest? What do you lean on? And for me, number one, I'm a Christian. Number two, I've got really one of the most incredible families that anyone could ask for. And so the combination of those two things where, you know, I can go to God and say, I'm not doing well this morning. Like, I'm going to need every ounce of lift you've got to give me. And then being able to immediately follow that up with a call to my mom or, you know, saying to my husband, like, let's drive to Dunkin' Donuts and share a coffee or something. Like, being able to be filled with this, you know, everybody has this different definition of spiritual, but spiritual could be, you know, me and you meeting up and talking for 2 hours about, you know, our life and our loves and our passions and everything else. And that's a spiritual experience. And so I think being filled with the spirit, however you consume that spirit, is vital. And I think the next thing is to say, like, whatever I can give today in whatever way or form I can give it is going to be my best. And coming to that place where you realize, like, my best is my best. My best may not be quote the best, but my best is my best. And if I'm bringing that every single day in volume, my life is going to be filled with a lot of best moments. And when you live with, you know, chronic pain, chronic fatigue, just in a way, like chronic helpless, like, you know, hopelessness, like, is this ever going to change? You've got to have those things that you just pull out of your pocket and say, even if it never changes, this is what I have in this moment, and appreciate it for what it is, because you are still mom, wife, sister, daughter, friend, you know, coworker, owner, whatever it is, whatever label you have. You, no matter if you're diseased or not, you're that. And so just bring it, like, bring who you are in your best way to the table. And don't ever be afraid to say, I'm struggling today. Because I think that's another thing that we underestimate. How many people will say, how can I support you? And once those words are uttered, you're unstoppable. You are literally unstoppable because now you've got a friend in it.
I love it. I we are going to do a cult something together, something great. I feel it. All right. So any other tips or tricks or advice before we let you get back on with your regularly scheduled programming for the day?
Yeah, I want to just speak out to those people that are listening. Number one, find your support using organizations like Spondylitis Association of America. Check in, tap in, search their website, listen to their podcasts. Get yourself educated, because an educated patient is an empowered patient, and an empowered patient lives their life on purpose and out loud. So that's number one. And then number two is, don't be so hard on yourself. Like, listener, do not be so hard on yourself. The world has a lot of hard things that we're going through together and things that are happening around us. But this is like the moment that you're living in right in this moment is the moment that matters the most. So embrace it. Find joy in it. Find peace in it. And celebrate that even though we might feel sick today, we've got today, we've got tomorrow, we've got every other day that we get to experience something beautiful. So be that beauty for other people and ask for it when you feel kind of less than or unfilled. That's what I would love to just leave the listening audience with, as someone who is a sister in what you're going through.
Beautiful. I'm speechless, and that doesn't happen often. Thank you so much, Sarah Loudon.
Thank you so much, Jill Miller, for having me. And I hope to be able to do much more with you.
We're going to do it. That's a wrap.
Awesome.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit, educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.